What's good, everybody? You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory at the University of British Columbia. I'm your host, Spencer Latu, and this is a progressive politics and current events show that speaks truth to power. Today's topics we will be discussing are the BC NDP versus Post Media on unions and BC's housing unaffordability crisis.
Public dollars to make those expenditures to build the next generation of skilled workers. And that's why I'm proud to announce today that the first community benefits agreement for British Columbia will start with the issuing of a tender for the Patella Bridge later today. There you go. We're getting started right away with the Patella procurement, but we're also focused on upcountry on the Highway 1 improvements between Kamloops and the Alberta border. That will be the second community benefits agreement that will be coming out later this summer.
That was BC Premier John Horgan. The video is courtesy of Vancouver Sun. The title, BC Government Introduces New Community Benefits Agreement. So what this is all about is that there will be, the headline from News 1130, a new BC Crown Corporation to oversee labor for public infrastructure projects. This was July 16th, so a little over a week ago. But the details include, quote, the BC government has created a new Crown Corporation to handle hiring and paying construction workers for provincial infrastructure projects in a move that's being lauded by unions but criticized by independent contractors. Premier John Horgan announced Monday the province has signed a community benefits agreement, CBA, which will make it a priority to hire people who live within close proximity to a construction project, Indigenous people and women, while paying union-level wages and having space for training and apprenticeships. The BC Infrastructure and Corporation, BCIB, has been created to oversee the CBA and to work with unions to hire laborers and manage things like payroll and benefits. The new rules will apply to work on a new Patella Bridge and the lane widening projects on the Trans-Canada Highway between Kamloops and the Alberta border, according to Horgan. Transportation Minister Claire Trevena says British Columbians deserve to work on major projects that are happening in their own communities. The BC Buildings Trade... Building Trades, BCBT, applauds the province's decision, calling it a good day for BC workers, families, and communities, unquote. So from these details, you can see the positives, which is that people in BC that are struggling to find work, we have our own unemployment crisis, just like most of the industrialized world. This will put people back to work that, you know, that live near the projects that are being built. So the projects referenced a couple times, there was the Patella Bridge. So that's people from the Lower Mainland can get back to work and work on that, especially in the Fraser Valley area. And even people in Kamloops and in the interior of British Columbia and the Kootenay region. So if those people are struggling for work, they can find jobs being supplied by the provincial government. And the only reason why I view that as a positive rather than a negative is people would say, oh, well, these people are working off the dole. These people are freeloading off of tax dollars. Well, the unfortunate reality of this situation is that the private sector in these areas has completely failed. And that is why the public sector has to step in and employ people, because in our society, the way you make money is through wage labor. And if wage labor isn't being offered by any private businesses, then the public sector needs to step in. And so the NDP government is doing an important thing for people that are struggling and the people that currently need jobs and are able to work, and especially underserved people are able to work. So if you note that there is they're focusing on Indigenous people and women. So that group has been historically underrepresented in the labor force. They've been chronically unemployed, and through no fault of their own, but also through discriminatory practices. And by having a universal approach of getting all Indigenous people involved that want to work on these projects, that will give them a chance to have some economic subsistence. Furthermore, there is union level wages in involved. So that would mean people would be making close to a living wage, if not a living wage, for doing construction, which is great, as people who do not have maybe as much education or have as much job experience are able to get working right away and make a decent living. They're not forced to work for minimum wage at Tim Hortons and get paid slave labor wages. As well, training and apprenticeships are going to be involved. So that's fantastic for people that want to do more in the construction field, and they're able to get those hours they need and get the experience they need to do more for their own, for themselves, as well as more for our economy and our projects that are being worked on in BC. So this also includes unions. So how unions are involved with this is that the BC government has made it explicitly clear that all these projects will be done by union only. They'll only have unionized workers. And so while that may seem a little bit authoritarian, saying you must be in a union, well, what this does for people is allows them to be organized as a labor force rather than being independent. Yeah, each individual worker being subjected to a contract, and they all have to go from employer to employee, have a one-on-one relationship. Instead, it is the employers and the that bargain with the entire workforce. And what that allows workers to do is have a larger voice and a more powerful voice, as it's not like myself as one worker going to my boss being like, hey, you know, working conditions aren't safe, I'm not getting paid enough and I don't have a pension. Well, and then the employer could turn around and be like, well, that's not good enough for you, with all these other people that are happy to take whatever scraps I'm willing to give them are happy with it. So if you don't pipe down, then you'll be removed. So by being in a union, workers have the ability to speak to employers in a meaningful manner and bargain for and have collective bargaining power for things that can actually help them. So as well, it also helps with the class consciousness that is lost in North America, because unfortunately, whether or not people want to hear it or not, most people are workers. Most people work for a living. They have a boss. They have someone owns their workplace, and that they merely sell their time, do the work that they're allotted to do in that time, and collect a collective paycheck. So that economic class that most of us inhabit, I have a job, I show up for my shift, and then I get my measly paycheck at the end of it. But that means that I'm a worker. I do not own my workplace. I do not own the tools of my workplace. I merely use them, and it is my body that does the work. And since I'm ununionized, I cannot go to my employer and be like, hey, you know, I don't like the way that things are being run. They'll be like, well, you know what, Spencer? If you got a problem with it, then you just go pack up your bags. And what is nice about the NDP is that although they have taken lots of donations from unions, it shows that they're on the side of working people, at least. And as we're going to cover later in the segment, there will be a false equivalency put forth saying how, oh, the NDP is taking union money. They're in the pocket of the unions. Well, the unions are us. So we are the unions. We are the workers. And if the government is in bed with the workers, I say let it be so, because the government is supposed to represent the people. It's supposed to be doing what the people want. So I mean, that's a big step forward in my opinion, as far as working class people are concerned. So the coverage of this outside of News 11:30. In the Vancouver Sun and Province. These are two papers owned by Post Media. Their flagship publication is the National Post, a conservative rag for anyone that reads it. It has wild conspiracy theories about every single person with an Islamic-sounding name, and they're notorious for publishing just crackpot right-wing, almost like propaganda, not nearly as bad as the Rebel Media, if anyone's ever seen that. That's kind of like the Canadian equivalent of Breitbart, but it's still pretty brutal. So the Vancouver Sun and Province, since they're owned by the same corporation, they are posting the same op-eds and same coverage pieces written by a couple of journalists, Vaughn Palmer and Rob Shaw. Who these people are, I don't really know. I'm fairly new to media in BC and Vancouver, but a quick Google search and looking at their Twitter feed shows that they are very liberal leaning. They are, well, not liberal, BC liberal leaning, or conservative for the rest of the country. It's, and the political spectrum. It's a bit misleading, their name, because the conservatives and liberals banded together in 1980 to have a coalition government and just kind of never separated. So they are conservative, although their name says otherwise. And these two are conservative-leaning people. I mean, it seems like they have a good place at Post Media that agrees with their ideology. However, their writing, as I will go on to show you, is, I would say, violating a little bit of journalistic standards as far as how biased it can be. So as far as the coverage is concerned, they did multiple pieces on it, so that's good. I mean, it's nice to see that people have lots to read. You know, it's not like people don't have too much to read these days. You know, it's not like many people are reading newspapers as it is. However, the op-eds they ran were only negative in the Vancouver Sun and Province, only bashing the NDP. And even in the quote-unquote news section they wrote about it was pretty much dedicated to bashing the NDP, bringing up historical precedents of past NDP governments, which you would think would have very little to do with the current NDP government, because the last time they were in power was the 90s. However, they're going to use that. They continually repeat that. So clearly it's on their mind, and it's a large piece of their evidence for why the NDP is doing a poor job of because of the past, which is a little bit of mental gymnastics, in my opinion, for someone to think that the government of the 1990s and the government of 2018 are the same, but that's just them. So we're going to get into it with the first op-ed by Vaughn Palmer. So this hopefully will show you their true colors and their priorities. And in my, and I assert their priority being that they are attack dogs for power and not merely journalists, because of the way they viciously go after unions and working people. It's pretty clear that they are not beholden to being objective journalists and sharing the truth or what's going on in government, keep making sure that government is transparent. Instead, it's pushing their their conservative anti-union ideology that is shared by Vaughn Palmer, Rob Shaw, and all of Post Media. So the first op-ed, Vaughn Palmer, the title is Vaughn Palmer, Horgan Rewards Old Union Friends as Promised. This was last updated July 16. It starts off in big, big font, quote, well before John Horgan became premier of BC, he signaled his intention to give the unionized building trades the inside track on government-funded construction projects, end quote. So while I appreciate him reporting on this, I don't appreciate him trying to make it sound as if the unions are getting a leg up and that they're going to get special treatment, because it's very misleading to people that think, oh, well, the union gets an unfair advantage, an unfair crack at construction bids. Well, who in as far as unionized people are concerned, it's not that the money from that the government's giving to the union is not going to be it's going to the workers. It's not just going to go into the pocket of the owner. So if this was a private company, the relationship is very different. They're going to take most of the money if they're like a private contractor. So hypothetically, Spencer's Construction Company Incorporated, I would take my personal cut as the owner of the company, and then I would give whatever, however little I could give based off of labor market or whatever I can get away with paying my construction workers. So by framing it as like the same kind of setup as if it was giving to a private person, a private place rather than a union, I feel is disingenuous. So later on, he in the article, he continues on to kind of paint a picture of how the two, John Horgan and the unions are all in bed together, and really great quote, then came the payback, unquote. What he's trying to say by getting them to say the whole payback thing is that the Liberals, as people have been, the BC Liberal Party, as people have been following, have been mired in scandals of corruption with casinos, organized crime, and just some very unscrupulous characters that the BC Liberals were totally fine with operating with in BC. And now, rather than own up to those mistakes and say corruption is horrible and we're going to stop enriching developers that are building only luxury condos while there's working people who can't afford to live in Vancouver in the city that they work in, they're just going to try to pin the same thing on the NDP, a nice little political tactic to make them seem as if they are just as bad as they are, rather than dealing with their own shortcomings. In the article, it continues, another great quote I picked out, forced unionization, in other words, and with selected NDP-approved unions. Quote, a sweetheart deal for organizations that have long supported the NDP in general and him in particular, unquote. So if those who don't really understand unions or haven't really paid attention to this much, it's a bit of a stretch to say, to view it as John Horgan's being an authoritarian, forcing people to unionize. They're not. It's just on their construction site because they want all the workers that are working for, working on the taxpayer dollar, working for the province of British Columbia, to be in unions, to have that worker solidarity. And viewing it as a sweetheart deal, it's not like the money is going into the pockets of the union. It's not like the government's funding the unions. It's that the government is funding the workers that will work for unions. It's comparable to the sweetheart deal that the Liberals gave to their private donors, who were all millionaires and even billionaires, that they could just take the millions of dollars that the BC Liberals were giving them and putting them just in their pockets, not even giving them to their workers. So if it poses a question, if where do you want your tax money to go? Do you want your tax money to go into the pocket of a billionaire or millionaire corporation, or do you want it to be spread amongst the workers so they can actually spend money and, hey, maybe afford a house at one point in their life in Vancouver? So the next little smear piece put up by our other journalist, Rob Shaw, the headline is BC Greens frustrated at NDP's ride hailing and union only construction announcements. So, what's going on with this one is, this was last updated July 23rd, 2018. Rob Shaw says, quote, he's quoting, BC Green Andrew Weaver. You can have a community benefit agreement, whether it's union or non-union, said Weaver. To say it must be union, it strikes of paying back political favors and is very troubling. The union-only construction rules are similar to a 1990s NDP program that critics said amounted to patronage for the public sector unions that supported NDP election campaigns. However, union and corporate donations are no longer allowed under a law that the NDP passed this year. So, what I take away from this is that, once again, the old political game is being played by the Liberals. They're trying to pin their own misdeeds onto the NDP about taking money from unscrupulous characters, putting it in their pockets, and more or less just expecting it back in campaign donations. However, even if we, you know, if we take if we can give this argument a try and even think that the NDP was doing this, they couldn't even take corporate donations or union donations anyways. So what is the benefit to the government other than having more workers go to work, having more people with more money in their pockets, having more people building desperately needed infrastructure in BC? It's just a rhetorical battle. It has nothing to do with what's actually happening, but merely just trying to get political gain at the expense of workers, which I think is very disgusting by the BC Liberals. Okay, we're going to have a quick break for commercials, and I'll be back in a second.
Crimes and Treasons Radio, this is Riff Raff. Every Tuesday from 9 to 11 p.m. on 101.9 FM. With Relly Rails and Jules Andre Brown.
Do you hear what I'm hearing?
Come enjoy British Columbia's beautiful wilderness with the UBC Varsity Outdoors Club. Try your hand at hiking, backcountry skiing, rock climbing, kayaking, and much more. Whether you're a beginner or an expert, we have trips happening every week, usually at no cost.
I'm just living my
Check us out online at ubc-voc.com. For everybody who should live it, live it, live it. Go and get it, you
should live it, live it, live it. SpongeBob, you're wasting me precious carbon dioxide. I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy. Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open me latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool.
The endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable. Big business does it again.
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Hey everybody, it's the Spencer Latu Show. I'm Spencer Latu, and we're broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory on UBC's Point Grey campus, CITR 101.9 FM. And we're back looking at the smear pieces written in the Vancouver Sun / Province and by the Post Media, massive media corporation, the One Media Corporation for those 1984 fans. And the next one we're going to look at is by Rob Shaw. He already put a nice little piece in there about showing the BC Greens' frustration, also, but defeating his own argument by trying to compare the unions as being sweethearts to the NDP, although the NDP cannot even take money from them because the NDP passed a law saying that no one is taking any more union and corporate donations. So that one seems a little bit misleading, but still, I guess for these conservative ideologues, they don't really see the nuance, nor do I think they care. So the next one is, the headline is Rob Shaw, NDP government's fast-paced sparks confusing announcements. A little text underneath says, Premier John Horgan has led a breakneck pace in his first year in office, but there have been some missteps and confusion along the way. So this was last updated July 22nd, 2018. Quote, it's possible in some parallel universe that last week was a good one for Premier John Horgan, but back here on Earth Prime, his government bungled two major press conferences, leaving a trail of confusion and self-inflicted errors that are worth noting as the NDP administration marks its first anniversary in power. So that quote kind of shows how smug this Rob character is, and he's trying to paint a picture of how brutal the NDP is doing with two really bad press conferences, according to him. But later in the article, he concedes that, quote, what the NDP has accomplished has been remarkable. Almost two-thirds of the NDP's more than 120 election promises are either completed or in progress, according to tracking by CBC's list-making savant, Justin McElroy, unquote. A little off-topic, but go follow Justin McElroy on Twitter. He's kind of a weirdo and posts some like very strange lists of things, but the lists are good, and you should check them out. So, back to the article. In one world, the NDP is doing such a brutal job, and they're having these self-inflicted errors and a trail of confusion. But in the same time, they're crushing their promises. Two thirds of more than 120 election promises are completed or in progress. So how do you have it both ways, Rob? That doesn't make any sense, you know. Like, do you really think that like the two major press conferences are really weighing on their on how they're doing, or is it just more of that you have a problem with them and you're just trying to jump on anything that they do that is not up to perfection, or just because they're not BC Liberals, which is who Rob Shaw is a big supporter of, and that just, in my opinion, and this isn't even an op-ed, so I mean. Oh, no, sorry, this is an op-ed, sorry. So in his op-ed, it just seems like it's a little bit of a, like, contradiction. And, like, as much as he's entitled to his own opinion on things, it's kind of bizarre to have them both in the same breath. Like, I appreciate him trying to be objective, but it is very misleading and extremely contradictory. So I think it just shows once again how he is working at the behest of his ideologues at Post Media. They're an anti-union corporation, which we will discuss later about how anti-union they are. Furthermore in the article, quote, potentially affecting billions of dollars in infrastructure spending and marking a hard left turn back to a 1990s model that rewarded the many trade unions that donated to and volunteered on NDP election campaigns, unquote. So this is a little bit of red baiting by our good friend Rob. Red baiting is, harassing or persecuting somebody for alleged communist sympathies. And although the Cold War is long over and the last communists left are, you know, the Chinese, he's still trying to red bait the NDP and make it seem as if they are trying to stage some worker-led revolution and saying how hard left they've turned, even though one of the strongest capitalist economies on earth, Germany, very strong unions everywhere in the country, even so strong that they have workers on their boards of directors because of the effect unions have had on their private sector. So to paint a picture that this is so leftist that we're turning into Venezuela or Cuba or a socialist country is he's just being silly. He knows better than that, but he'll say whatever he needs to say because he's getting, not only is he an ideologue that believes that unions are horrible and the worst thing to happen, but also the corporation he works for is anti-union as well. So he makes a perfect lapdog and a perfect attack dog for whenever workers are trying to get a little bit more scraps from their employers. And once again, he's making that assertion that the trade unions that donate and volunteer are getting a kickback. Well, it sounds like the problem that the liberals had when they were allowing criminals to launder money in casinos, except here these are working people, law-abiding citizens, and they're not getting donations. There's no donations coming from the unions. The unions donated $5 million to the first campaign, but that's nothing compared to how much money the liberals took in from their developer buddies and all the other special interests that donated to them. So it's a huge false equivalency here, and I just view it as more of a political game of like trying to pin, oh well, the liberals are corrupt because they're taking money from corporations and they're selling out working people, but the NDP are also quote unquote corrupt too because they're helping out unions. The corruption is not the same. It's not the same people, and the people that try to make that assertion are just being silly. So this is supposed to be the objective piece of news about the whole union thing. The headline is Union Labor to Build Billions in BC Projects Under New NDP Policy. This is written by Rob Shaw again and Jennifer Saltman, last updated July 17th. This one goes over the whole details of everything with a very negative slant. But what I found extremely interesting is when they got near the bottom of the article where they started talking about their sources for how much this is going to cost and the economic impact. So, quote, Cardis, a faith-based think tank and registered charity, released a report on Monday looking at the potential costs of imposing project labor's agreements on infrastructure projects. The report estimates that the province has $25.6 billion in bridge, road, hospital, school, and hydro projects planned for the next 3 years, such as the Site C Dam, Highway 1 upgrades, and the George Massey Tunnel replacement, and cites research that restricted bidding blocks 8 out of 10 contractors from bidding on projects. As a result, contract prices could go up between 2 and 25%. Or in BC's case, $512 million to $6.4 billion. Restricted bidding isn't in the public interest, said report author Brian Dichkema. It plays favorites with a small group of firms, placing specific corporate interests over the interests of the public paying for the projects, the interests of construction workers, and the interests of the construction industry. So that's a bit shocking to hear, as we've kind of discussed how this is going to unions. It's not going into the private sector. It's coming out of taxpayer money to pay for people that are indigenous people who are out of work in the local areas. So the way he's framing this, Cardis guy is framing things, is completely bizarre. But what's even more bizarre is the fact they cited a faith-based think tank and registered charity, Cardis, in a Vancouver Sun piece. Well, that raise the question of a few people. And Press Progress did a great piece on this on July 16th. The title is, Why is Media Citing the Social Conservative Group as Experts on BC's New Local Jobs Agreement? Which is an important question, because where did they come from? Why are they the most important people? What comment on this, on the economic impact of this, and who are they, and what other research have they done? So Press Progress did some fantastic research. Quote, some of BC's biggest media outlets are presenting a dubious social conservative think tank as experts on labor agreements. Here's just a quick snapshot of some of the think tank's latest research. One report titled, Marriage is Good for Your Health, claims the traditional institution of marriage has numerous health advantages, including quicker recovery from illness and better odds of surviving a heart attack, while an additional report claims common law relationships can lead to negative health outcomes. Neither report is authored by a medical doctor. Another report accuses the International Monetary Fund of coercing Canadian mothers into the workforce by calling for childcare investments, while other reports argue social assistance for single mothers gives them an incentive to never get married. Elsewhere, the social conservative think tank, which says it is called upon to uphold the free market, calls on unions to stop focusing on collective bargaining and organize social activities for their members instead. This is not a joke, by the way. So Press Progress goes on. This is who's BC's biggest media outlets are trotting out as experts. To that, I answer yes, because as fellow conservative ideologues, these people don't seem to care about facts. They don't care to see about reality. They think that somehow having a barbecue is more important than asking for more pay. Like, that will somehow make a difference in people's lives. Well, it's not. The only way to make a real difference is to have collective bargaining, to have organization amongst workers so that they can ask, if not then demand, that they get their fair share of the pie of revenue going on. The article continues, quote, according to their report, Cardis claims the community benefits agreement could cause public infrastructure costs to rise anywhere from 2 to 25% or $512 million to $6.4 billion. As a question of morality, the social conservative think tank argues companies bidding on public contracts should face no restrictions whatsoever. However, the report does not discuss the morality of rewarding companies that pay workers below wages, below industry averages, or exploit temporary foreign workers to avoid paying local workers a fair wage, both of which are addressed by the new agreement. This is important because whenever the socially conservative or the Christian conservative people enter the conversation, they try to say that they're the moral majority and that they know what's best for everybody, because that their pious faith in God will never allow them to do anything that's wrong to another person. However, here they don't seem to care about whether or not it's fair that these people abuse the temporary foreign workers program, which allows people to get paid less than the minimum wage, not even close to a living wage, but less than the minimum wage that Canadians can get paid. So if that's what private companies are willing to do to put more money in their own pockets, I feel like they're in the immoral majority of countries out here, companies out here. And furthermore, they're okay with paying people less than a living wage, and even that below industry averages. So not only are people don't make enough money to live in Vancouver, they don't even get enough money compared to their fellow workers within the industry. So, I mean, as much as the barbecue would sound fun and how much fun they'd have chit-chatting about, well, it'd be nice if we could get paid more. If they had a union, then they could demand so. So the article ends, quote, nor do they have much to say about the morality of hiring companies that will send that money offshore rather than reinvesting in BC's local communities, something that is also addressed by the new agreement. It would be nice to know what social conservative think tanks think about that, especially considering people with real expertise in the area say the new agreement includes several things that could be helpful for workers, unquote. So, once again, playing on the whole morality concept, by paying people from BC around these projects, it allows people to have money to spend, and that allows more goods and services to be consumed and helps the economy in general. However, they don't really seem to care, the conservatives, I mean, and the Christian conservatives, the social conservatives, whatever you want to call them. I prefer the term right-wing crazies. But whatever they want to do is... basically what they're trying to lobby for is allowing the status quo of taking government money and putting it in the pockets of corporate of big corporations who pay their executives, their management, exorbitant salaries while paying the workers very little. So by doing that, it just creates a sharp decline in aggregate demand. So that means that since the workers are taking so little money home, they're unable to spend that money, and they're unable to stimulate the economy by making people create more goods and services for them. So although they claim to be the people that are asking for a better society, they're the ones destroying ours right now. So some more context for Post Media. Post Media is a $750 million media giant in Canada. Their flagship is the National Post, conservative rag. It's a terrible paper. I don't recommend reading it. It's pretty funny if you want to kind of get what the crazies are up to in Canada. However, they're so biased against media that Post Media themselves defeated a union drive at the National Post. And we know this because Tanara Yelland at Canada Land wrote an article, the headline, "How Post Media Defeated a Union Drive at the National Post." And in the article, they describe the lengths that management went on to keep the newsroom from unionizing. So what they Post Media did was they gave everyone, they offered people raises, buyouts, and they sent in their bigwig executives into the National Post to talk to everybody and kind of dissuade them away from a union. And while everyone's entitled to their own opinion, people were only trying to unionize because they were losing their jobs, and they felt that through a union they were able to save their livelihood and also save journalism, because as Post Media continues to pay their executives lots of money, they are unable to keep journalists employed, and the last thing journalists want to do is lose their jobs. And more importantly, I feel like they see the duty that they have to democracy, to be employed, to have big newsrooms where government can continue to be transparent. A good quote from the article, quote, "The Financial Post columnist Terrence Corcoran took issue with the strategy of unionizing against a company that is essentially losing millions of dollars worth of business every day, practically calling it self-destructive." Just a quick note, what he's referring to is he's suggesting that Post Media, the $750 million media empire, is losing money, which I think is kind of funny. The quote goes on, quote, "When asked if he feels similarly about the executives who receive retention bonuses totaling almost $2.3 million from the same poorly performing company, Corcoran says he doesn't know enough about the details of the much publicized story, but concedes it seemed a bit inappropriate from a PR perspective," unquote. So yes, Terrence, it is extremely, it looks really bad for you as everyone at the top of the organization is stuffing their pockets with millions of dollars, while the people who are actually generating the profits, the journalists, the workers, and the people that are on the ground actually making sure that the government is held accountable, that the powerful are being scrutinized by the public. He doesn't seem to care as long as the bonuses are getting paid out to the company bigwigs, and that the share price and shareholders, there's some American hedge funds involved with the Post Media, and it seems like that is their true constituency, not even journalism, and certainly not democracy. We're going to take a short break for some commercials. We will be right back.
After decades of decline, drowning fatalities have been rising dramatically in Canada since 2004. Most drowning victims had no intention of going in the water, and harmless situations can become dangerous quickly. This summer, if you're going out on the water, even if you're not planning on going in it, be water smart and be prepared. Here are some things you can do to reduce your risk of drowning. Learn to swim and swim to survive. If you can tread water for a minute, you can orient yourself, and if you can swim 50 meters in a pool, you'll most likely be able to swim to safety in open water. Most drowning fatalities occur within just 15 meters of safety. Wear a life jacket or personal flotation device. 80% of all boating deaths were people who were not wearing one. Take a marine safety course, and if you're going kayaking or canoeing, know how to get out of your craft if it flips over. Practice basic safety moves such as wet exits and self-rescues. Save the alcohol for dry land after you're done playing on the water. and never go out alone. For more information and more safety tips, go to lifesaving.bc.ca.
Come and feel our positive energy at Falun Dafa Fellowship. Falun Dafa, also called Falun Gong, is an ancient spiritual discipline based on the principles of truthfulness, compassion, and tolerance. It's a self-cultivation practice that improves mental and physical wellness through meditation and simple exercises. It's been well documented to improve mind and body, relieve stress and anxiety, increase energy and vitality, and promote morality and spirituality. Why not give yourself a chance to learn free of charge? To learn more, please visit our website at falundafafellowship.com.
Old or New Testament?
I think the New Testament.
The question is, Pilate. Remember Pilate from the New Testament?
What's Pilate? He fiddled while...
Yeah, no, well, just a minute. Let me ask the question, then you can give me the answer, okay? Did Pilate want Jesus to be crucified?
Pontius Pilate washed his hands of it.
So did he want him to be crucified?
Yeah.
No. No. No.
Tune in every Friday afternoon,
3:30
to the
Well, find a good church. It'll help you.
Hey, everybody. We're back. You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory at UBC's Point Grey campus. So to sum up, post-media versus the BC NDP on unions, well, what we could take away from that is that Postmedia is a massive corporation worth $750 million Canadian. They are right-wing ideologues, right-wing crazies, as I like to call them. But they have their attack dogs, Rob Shaw and Vaughn Palmer, smearing to death the BC NDP's decision. And while I'm not a NDP diehard by any stretch of the imagination, I try to pride myself in not being a partisan hack. I will call out the NDP where I feel like they're not doing a good job or not doing enough. For example, I feel like their marijuana laws are too oppressive for people. You can't grow a marijuana plant in public. What is it? Like, is that offensive to people or something? Anyways, back to unions. And what Postmedia is doing, I believe, is detrimental to democracy because they're using their money, their power, their journalists, the apparatus that they've constructed to disseminate their own views in what is supposed to be objective journalism. It's supposed to be reporting. You know, they're supposed to be doing what I'm doing. You know, they're supposed to be speaking truth to power. Instead, they are repeating what the powerful want to hear. And that is what I feel is the greatest threat to democracy, is a corporate consolidation of power, corporate consolidation of media, and allows them to say whatever the person who owns Postmedia, Conrad Black, who is a unscrupulous character, if you wish to look him up, that these people have the largest megaphone imaginable, and it's touted as what's supposed to be a completely objective megaphone. However, it's clearly a right-wing crazy message that they're spreading all across Canada. Okay, so moving on. Housing unaffordability. Yes. Can you believe this? Headline, Vancouver's real estate market ranks as least affordable in North America. This was written by Carissa Wilson of Livable on July 24th. So to the article, quote, Simon Fraser, University adjunct professor Andy Yan, used 2016 census data to determine the affordability index ratios of major metropolitan areas across Canada and the United States. Greater Vancouver took the top spot for the worst housing affordability with a ratio of 11. This means the median home price of $800,000 is 11 times the median household income of $72,662. Los Angeles and San Jose followed Vancouver with a ratio of 8.8 and 8.3 respectively, unquote. Oh, goodness, people. We are in hot water because if you can even make as much money as the average person, the median, well, not the average, but the median income of $72,000, you'll need 11 of those to afford a home, which just basically tells everyone that's living here that is not inheriting a small loan of $1 million from their parents or doesn't have shares in Kinder Morgan, that you are not going to do too well in the housing market. And it doesn't look like there's anything we can do about it. It appears as if that people aren't making enough money, which I feel like $72,000 is about right, or that housing pricing and the way that housing is being done in Vancouver is out of control, which I will take that side rather than people need to make more money and we need to extract more. Anyways, so we're moving on to the Georgia Strait that posted this headline: social housing for the rich. Families earning over $100,000 qualify at Vancouver West End Project. This is written by Carlito Pablo on July 25th. The article, quote, families earning up to $104,000 are still deemed eligible to live in the social housing component of a proposed Vancouver West End development. Singles with a maximum income of $71,000 can also qualify for these homes, according to a city staff report. An annual income of $104,000 is not what poor families typically earn. Well, you think? In fact, that income is even way above the earnings of what the city of Vancouver considers moderate income households, as we've covered previously. Based on the city's measure, a family is earning a moderate income if it gets between $30,000 and $80,000 a year. High-earning families can now qualify for social housing because social housing is no longer what many people think it is. It used to be that low-income people often lived in social housing, but not anymore in Vancouver. Under the leadership of the ruling Vision Vancouver Party, the city has redefined social housing. Social housing now means developments wherein 30% of the units are earmarked for renters who cannot pay average market rents. Although the rest of the units are rented out at market rates, the entire assembly is considered social housing. Wow. So it's clear that the Vision Vancouver Party has absolutely no care to do anything to help people get into homes. So in Vancouver, and it's very apparent in Seattle, I was just there a couple weeks ago. It's very apparent in Portland, I was there a year ago. And I'm pretty sure in Los Angeles, I've heard reports that, and basically every single major city in America, that homelessness, and everywhere in Canada as well, homelessness is a major problem. But also in Vancouver, we have our unique problem of not enough people affording to buy homes, and we now have empty homes and luxury condos with no one living in them. So it seems that we have this issue where there's empty homes and people without homes. I wonder if there's a way we could solve that. But Vision Vancouver, Gregor Robertson, now is in his lame duck status. Thank God he's walking away from Vancouver and into a cushy real estate job, probably because he's best friends with all these developers. Their solution to this is to create social housing, which is only for people who are making well below the median. So we're dealing with the top half of society, of top half of earners, and we're leaving the bottom half of earners out to dry. Don't get me wrong, I am an ex-athlete. I love the idea of meritocracy. I love the idea of getting what you earn. But at the same time, it's kind of ridiculous that people who work 40 hours a week don't get a shelter. We all need shelter to live. We'll die without shelter. And in a city where there's these people that are working, they're certainly working at the Tim Hortons, the service industry jobs, and they're struggling to make ends meet. They're struggling to own a home. They're relegated to indentured servitude level. And what the political establishment in charge right now has said, let them eat cake, and we're going to serve the people who need social housing, the people that earn six figures. They're the ones that need the new social housing. So that is one part of what Vision Vancouver is up to. The second part, which is I find extremely depressing, and I'm very sad to see this happen, is that the view cone, the view protection policy has now been scrapped, basically thrown out by the Vision Vancouver. So what happened yesterday, this is from an article on the Tai, another great website. Headline, don't let the city and development endanger Vancouver's mountain views. If the city allows False Creek towers to pierce a protected view cone, other developers may get the same treatment. So what happened here, this article is written by Sandy James on July 24th. What happened here was there's a False Creek real estate development. They're going to build a 40-story tower. And with the top 10 from 30 to 40, those ones are going to pierce the view cones. And what the view cones are from 27 different viewpoints in the city that significant views of the mountains and ocean can be seen. So in 1989, they decided that building heights at key locations need to be they need to be regulated so that expansive mountain and ocean views can be seen from all over the city. So naturally, the private sector wants to take, rather than leave it be a public good and allow everybody to see the ocean, they just want their residents to see it. So they can build the extra 10 stories on these towers and be like, hey guys, you know, we're violating the law and only you will get the view of the ocean and the mountains. So in a way, it's kind of like, In my opinion, at least, taking the public good and giving it, because these people are obviously not going to be helping any homeless shelters or deal with an affordability crisis. In fact, they're just going to exacerbate it. They're taking the public good, taking the profits from the public good, stuffing it in their pockets, and leaving us all out here to dry when there's clear problems that need to be worked on in the city. So the article in the Tai was laying out the case of why this can't continue, because obviously if one developer can do it, then all the developers get to do it. And then the next thing you know, we don't get to see the mountains unless you can afford the penthouse in these in the tallest building that is now being obstructed. So now we're basically once again saying that the views are just for the rich and everyone else that can't afford it. Well, you know, you can look at pictures of old Vancouver if you really want to see what it was like. So they're really hoping that this wouldn't go through. But as of yesterday, July 25th, city council approved the view piercing 400-foot tower on the condition that it be 100% market rental housing. And if they don't do that, they also have the option of building the 300-foot tower. But so that wouldn't pierce the view cones. And in my opinion, this is just kind of a brutal decision by the city council. It seems that they don't really seem to care about the natural beauty that Vancouver embodies, that people all over the world that come here and say it's the most beautiful city on earth, that they're willing to sell it for the low, low price of a 400-foot condominium tower. And furthermore, they're selling it to the public as it's going to be market rental housing. And, well, I'm not sure what that means, but from extrapolating the words, market being that they use the market of the most unaffordable city in North America to rent homes to people. So if we're going off of the market, which makes it the most unaffordable city, that's just going to make it even worse because it's just more condos at the same unaffordable prices. There's people who are making $30,000 to $80,000, can't afford to own these, let alone rent these places, and the view of it's gone. And guess where all the money that's being, that's all the value that's being created from this tower goes in the pockets of the developer Pavco, which I can only assume Gregor Robertson that's where his new job's going to be. So if anyone wants to put money on this, I'm going to say he's probably has a job lined up at Pavco after this for what a sweet deal he's giving these people. And what I can say about this is it's going to break my heart as to see the city devolve into this race to the bottom of how much we can extract from the natural beauty of the city and how much we can sell it to developers rather than doing anything just such as making sure that people have enough to eat, making sure that people have a place to live, and making sure that people have a dignified existence in Vancouver. how I can tie this all together from the media debacle that was the coverage on the union construction thing and the whole the view cone and unaffordability is that it seems as if the powers that be, the wealthiest people, do not have the interests of most in mind and in their project to further consolidate their power. So, for example, Post Media, all they care about is getting more viewers, more readers, and more ad money. And the way they see they can do that is that they can run more and more articles about local topics that people are trying to learn about, which I do not fault anyone for going to the Vancouver Sun for trying to learn. But through that, they can spread their own ideology that is anti-union, anti-worker, and whilst doing that, consolidate their power to only put more out there and to further slant the table, further slant the discussion in their favor. And so that's basically the same plan as the developers, as they're going to use as much money as they can muster from ripping people off in Vancouver to spend and do more damage. So, for example, the housing crisis started years ago. Probably, I would say, when things are getting crazy was when the Olympics were announced. And since then, the housing prices have just gone up and up and up and up. And so developers that capitalize on that moment have just been making more and more money hand over fist. And now it's gotten to this point about, it was announced about like 2008. So we're almost a decade past where they have enough money to break the view cone policy. They have enough power. They have enough influence over Gregor Robertson and the Vision Vancouver Party so that they can push through this precedent setting condo tower. And now they can privatize the public good of the mountains and the ocean view for their own gain, such as Post Media is privatizing the good of journalism and people trying to be educated on politics in their own province for their own personal gain, which is where I would step in and say what we need as a society is to say that there are some things that we cannot put a price on. We can't put a price on hard-hitting journalism. We can't allow that to become a game or an advertising race. It needs to be protected so that it can serve its function in democracy, which is transparency in the government and holding the powerful private interests as well accountable. And as well, if the city of Vancouver decides and the people of Vancouver decide that they want to keep the beautiful view of the mountains and the ocean around, they can't just give in for the small price of a developer who's not even going to give the money to the people or to the city. They're just going to put it in their pocket, which I believe is completely unjust. So to solve these problems, we all need to get active. We all need to stay informed, and we all need to speak out against the corporatization of our world. Thank you for listening. I'm going to be signing off right now, and tune in next week, and we're going to be covering more stories from around the city and around the province and around the world. Thank you.
directly affected by the LGBT purge in the Canadian Armed Forces, RCMP, or Federal Public Service? If so, a legal settlement may affect your rights. You may be eligible to receive compensation of $5,000 to $50,000 or more in cases of exceptional harm, as well as other non-financial benefits, or